Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is Wednesday, February 16, 2022, and the time is 1:32 p.m. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a forum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 172, Mental Health Facilities and Meds, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Last year, we took up the bill, adopted a committee substitute, took questions from the committee, opened and closed public testimony, and held the bill for further review. Since then, our office has worked with the Department of Health and Social Services, the Department of Law, and the Alaska Mental Health Trust to make necessary adjustments to the bill. We have before us today a proposed committee substitute. Here to present a summary of the committee substitute is my staff, Emma Potter. Ms. Potter, if you'd please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you can begin your remarks. And we'll also hear a sectional analysis before we adopt the CS.
Okay. Good afternoon, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, this is Emma Potter, staff to Representative Clayman. I'm going to provide a high-level summary of changes that are seen in the version before you, which is version W of House Bill 172. The focus of the bill remains on public safety and creating a graduated system of care for Alaskans struggling with mental illness and in crisis. We structured the bill so that the statute reflects the three phases of care. Crisis stabilization centers, which are the subacute mental health facilities with a maximum stay of 23 hours and 59 minutes. Crisis residential centers, which are the subacute mental health facilities with a maximum stay of 7 days. And designated evaluation and treatment facilities, which provide psychiatric inpatient services for individuals experiencing a psychiatric crisis, starting with a 30-day involuntary commitment. The committee substitute reflects efforts to protect patient rights. Version W aligns all patient rights in all of the hearings. The initial version created a second track with a longer period that a patient could be held without judicial review. This version amends it so that all patients held in crisis stabilization, crisis residential, or for a 30-day hold receive a hearing within 72 hours of arrival. All petitions trigger a hearing within 72 hours of arrival at the facility. The CS reflects different levels of proof for detention at a crisis residential center and involuntary commitment. The burden of proof for detention at a crisis residential center is probable cause. The burden of proof for involuntary commitment at a designated evaluation and treatment facility is clear and convincing evidence.
Just a short pause, Representative Eastman joined us at approximately 1:36.
The intent of this bill is to protect patient rights. And by applying the probable cause standard to detention at the crisis residential facilities, it allows patients to maintain rights such as gun rights. Another update found in the committee substitute is that the maximum stay at a crisis residential is increased from 5 days to 7 days. This change is based on Medicaid coverage limits. The CS clarifies who provides and receives notice of an ex parte petition and the time and place of the 72-hour hearing. In the CS, the court will provide notice of the 72-hour hearing to the respondent, the respondent's attorney, the respondent's guardian, if any, the petitioner's attorney, if any, and the attorney general. And then finally, this version cleans up some of the language so that it conforms with statute. The CS changes the reference to the peace officer definition to AS 0110060 subsection A, which is more accurate, and the provisions related to crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers as an alternative to arrest are unchanged in the committee substitute. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now move on to a sectional analysis of the committee substitute. On team to take us through the sectional is Heather Carpenter, Senior Policy Advisor, Department of Health and Social Services. Ms. Carpenter, please identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks. And there should be also a printed sectional analysis that was distributed in advance.
Thank you, Representative Clayman. I'm just doing a quick sound check. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. For the record, this
say
is
not
Heather
too
Carpenter.
Loud and clear.
This is Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor to the Department of Health and Social Services. So I will walk you through a sectional that will conform with what Emma provided. So high-level sections 1 through 10, I'm going to walk through pretty quickly because these start on page 1, line 5, through page 3, line 24. And these are all conforming edits to the alternative to arrest statutes. They add crisis residential center as another facility a peace officer may deliver a person in as an alternative to arrest. And as a reminder, this option was authorized under Senate Bill 120 that was passed in 2020. And some of the members may remember it as HB 290. Currently,
Representative Kirk had joined us at 1:38. Please continue.
Thank you. As a reminder, this current authority allows an officer at their discretion to deliver a person to a crisis stabilization center, a crisis residential center, an evaluation facility, instead of arresting them if the officer believes that the person is suffering from an acute episode of mental illness and if the person voluntarily agrees to be taken to a crisis stabilization center or an evaluation facility. I do want to call out that Section 7 amends the definition of a crisis stabilization center to have the meaning given in AS 4730915, which is actually updated in Section 22 of this bill. And Section 9 and 10 were also part of the alternative to arrest bill. These sections add conforming amendments to add crisis residential center to the mandatory arrest for crimes involving domestic violence, violation of protective orders, and violation of conditions of release statutes that are found in AS 1865-530. So in the meat of the bill, which starts actually on Section 11, you'll find that on page 3, line 25 through page 4, line 16. We are amending AS 4730705, and this expands the category of who can cause a person to be taken into custody for delivery to a crisis stabilization center, a crisis residential center, an evaluation facility, or a treatment facility. This new language actually allows a health officer, as newly defined in Section 22, it allows the existing mental health professional, as defined in AS 4730915-13, or a physician's assistant licensed by the state medical board, all in addition to a peace officer. I want to note that all of the provider types that the language has being deleted are actually captured in the definition of a mental health professional. And a physician assistant is currently not in the definition of a mental health professional, which is why it is called out separately. We did add the new term health officer, since the definition of peace officer currently found in 4730915 is being amended in Section 21 of the bill to be consistent with how it is defined elsewhere in statute. We actually take the terms that are being deleted in the current peace officer definition and move them into that new health officer term. Also in this section on page 4, lines 4 through 7, we clarify that a person is taken into custody by a peace officer or health officer and then delivered to the nearest crisis stabilization center, crisis residential center, evaluation facility, or treatment facility. The desire here is to divert care to the most appropriate facility type for someone in a mental health crisis to receive immediate care instead of having to be diverted to emergency rooms or jails. This section also clarifies that a person taken into custody may not be placed in a jail or other correctional facility except for as protective custody purposes while they await transportation to a subacute mental health facility or an evaluation facility. An example of this, there might be a community that has no safe place to hold somebody, for instance, out in rural Alaska. So someone may have to be held in a community jail until transportation can be arranged to a hub city. So moving on to Section 12. That starts on page 4, line 17, and we are adding a new section that requires a peace officer or a health officer to prioritize delivery to a crisis stabilization center if one exists in the area served by the peace officer or health officer. And our desire here is to not have a peace officer transport someone, say, from Dillingham into Anchorage. But, for instance, if somebody was out in Houston experiencing a mental health crisis and a crisis stabilization center exists in Wasilla, we would want that peace officer to prioritize delivering that individual there instead of an emergency room. So Section 13 is a pretty big section. This is the real meat of the addition. So I'm going to take it by each new area. So on page 4, line 23 through page 5, line 8, this is where we're adding the new 4730707. and this allows for admission to and detention at a crisis stabilization center or a crisis residential center. It gives the following options and rights for a patient. So A, it requires a mental health professional to examine the patient who's delivered there within the first 3 hours after arrival. And it specifies that a hold at a crisis stabilization facility can last no longer than 23 hours and 59 minutes. Subsection B creates a new process for evaluation, stabilization, and treatment at crisis residential centers. As a reminder, these are less restrictive alternatives to traditional and voluntary commitment holds that happen at what we call DETs, or Designated Evaluation and Treatment Facilities, or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And as Emma mentioned, we are setting this at probable cause in order to hold somebody. So moving on to the next area, which starts on page 4, line 9, through page 7, line 21, this adds a new section, 4730708. This is for admission to and detention at a crisis residential center with the following rights and options for a patient. So again, subsection A requires that a mental health professional examine the patient's mental and physical condition within 3 hours after arrival. Subsection B allows the mental health professional who performs the emergency examination under A to admit the person to the crisis residential center if, one, they are mentally ill and the condition causes the patient to be gravely disabled or to present the likelihood of serious harm to themselves or others, and two, the patient's acute behavioral health crisis will be resolved during admission to the crisis residential center. Subsection C allows the mental health professional to apply for an ex parte order under 4730700 if admission is made to a crisis residential center and a judicial order has not been obtained yet. Subsection D is a real important subsection. It requires the court to set a time frame for a 72-hour evaluation hearing to be held if needed within 72 hours after the patient's arrival to a crisis stabilization center or crisis residential center, whichever is earlier. And I just want to point out that this change is really important to note. It aligns with the current process for 72-hour evaluations and how they currently happen when somebody is admitted to API or a DET for evaluation. This change was the result of a lot of conversation and concerns from advocates, the Disability Law Center, and the public defenders. It was in order to have the process mirror the current process under law and to protect patient rights. Subsection E sets forth the requirements for a petition filed in court for a 30-day commitment or for detention at a crisis stabilization center. Subsection F provides for the court reviewing a 30-day commitment petition under subsection D to hold the next hearing in accordance with 4730735. Subsection G provides for patients' rights that are found in 4730735B, numbers 1 through 9, when a court is reviewing a petition for detention under subsection D to a crisis residential center. And I will note that it allows the court to order a patient to be detained at a crisis residential center for up to 7 days from the date of first admission to either a crisis stabilization center if they started out there, or a crisis residential center if the court has, again, probable cause. I just want to note, you know, you'll see that language, whichever happens first for that admission. So in this model, some communities will have, you know, all three legs of the stool, which would start with a crisis stabilization center or that 23-hour center, and allow the patient to then move to a crisis residential center, which would allow somebody to stay for up to 7 days. So we want it to be known that if an individual starts out at a crisis stabilization center and moves to a crisis residential center, that 72-hour clock starts when they enter that crisis stabilization center. Continuing, page 7, lines 22 through page 8, line 16, adds the new section 4730709. And these are rights of respondents at crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers. Subsection A requires that if at any time during an involuntary hold at a crisis stabilization center or crisis residential center, the patient no longer meets the standards for a stabilization hold or detention, that they can no longer be held or detained, and the court must be notified if applicable. Subsection B provides for the patient's rights when being held voluntarily at a crisis stabilization center or crisis residential center. A couple examples of these rights are the right to communicate immediately with your guardian or attorney of your choice, the right to be represented by an attorney, and the right to be notified of your rights. Subsection C allows for the patient to convert to voluntary status for care. This is important to note that many individuals do switch to voluntary care. And subsection D allows a crisis stabilization center or crisis residential center to administer crisis psychotropic medications that are consistent with the practice permitted in 4730-838 that currently exists for evaluation and designated treatment facilities. Subsection E adds language to clarify how time is calculated in this section for the 23-hour and 59-minute holding period at a crisis stabilization center and a 7-day detention hold at a crisis residential center. I just want to note, you'll also see the term professional person in charge throughout this section, and that has the meaning found in 4730-915-17, and that means the senior mental health professional at a facility or that person's designee. In the absence of a mental health professional, it means the chief of staff or a physician designated by the chief of staff. Okay, so taking a breath, section 14 is found on page 8 and starts on line 17. It provides clarifying edits to 4730-710, our current examination and hospitalization statute, and it removes references to crisis stabilization center because that is now found in the new 4730-707 and 708 that I had just addressed under section 13. It adds language to allow a mental health professional after examination to either, one, admit the person to a crisis residential center, two, hospitalize the respondent, or three, arrange for emergency hospitalization. Section 15, starting on page 9, line 8, adds a new subsection C to 4730-710 to require an application for an ex parte order if a judicial order is not in place, and adds a new subsection D requiring that a mental health professional apply for an ex parte order if a patient is readmitted to an evaluation facility after discharge from a subacute mental health facility and is not willing to stay voluntarily. And it does require the patient to stay at the evaluation facility until the court issues a decision on that ex parte application. Just as a practical matter, if someone is readmitted on a new ex parte order, their 72-hour clock starts over at zero. Section 16 starts on page 9, line 21. It amends AS 4730-715 to clarify that orders for evaluation are directed to evaluation facilities and to require admission of the patient for a 72-hour evaluation to determine if a petition for a 30-day commitment should be filed. And it does require the court to notify certain individuals of the hearing arrangements. Section 17 is found on page 10, starting on line 2, and it amends the computation of time statute to include computation for proceedings or transportation to a crisis residential center. And it also adds a new computation for the 7-day detention at a crisis residential center. Section 18 starts on page 10, line 28, and it amends AS 4730-838C to include crisis stabilization centers and crisis residential centers as a type of facility authorized to administer psychotropic crisis medication when there is a crisis situation and the patient requires immediate medication to prevent significant physical harm to themselves or other. Current law does allow a facility to administer 3 periods of crisis medication without further court approval, but it does state that a facility should consider the patient's view on how to manage future crises. And just a note, currently this statute only applies to evaluation facilities or treatment facilities, which again are those designated evaluation and treatment facilities that I mentioned, or API. And the specific hospitals in Alaska that operate as DETs are Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Matsu Regional Medical Center, and Bartlett Regional Hospital. Okay, moving on to section 19. It starts on page 11, line 3, and it adds a new section to 4730, to require the department to adopt regulations to implement these changes. Section 20 on page 11, line 6, it amends the definition for evaluation facility to mean a department-designated hospital or crisis residential center that has been designated to perform evaluations, or a medical facility operated by the federal government that performs evaluations. The current term of a healthcare facility could mean a hospice facility, for instance, and the department would never designate one of those as an evaluation facility, which is why we're trying to be more precise. This CS clarifies that it means facilities designated to perform evaluations or a medical facility operated by the federal government that performs evaluations. A tribally operated facility, such as the YKHC Hospital in Bethel, would be a great example of the latter facility. And one key requirement here is the term designated by the department, and what we're looking for there is a facility that has enough time to perform one of those 72-hour evaluations to determine if somebody meets criteria for a 30-day commitment. Section 21 starts on page 11, line 12, and it amends the definition of peace officer that is currently found in 4739.15.15 to have the meaning given in AS01-10-060A. And as a reminder, this conforms with how peace officer is defined elsewhere in statute. Section 22, page 11, line 19, amends the definition section to add new definitions for a crisis residential center, a crisis stabilization center, a health officer, and a subacute mental health facility. And I just want to point out, since health officer is a new term, we're actually moving the types that were deleted in the peace officer definition that was found in 915, and we're moving them to this new definition, and we are adding new terms of an EMT, a paramedic, or a firefighter. And those are important additions to align with the work that's currently happening in Anchorage and other communities around the state to implement mobile crisis teams. Section 23 amends the licensing statutes that are found in 4732.010B to change crisis stabilization centers to subacute mental health facilities. And Section 24 adds a new paragraph to the licensing statute definitions to define subacute mental health facilities in those statutes, and it provides a definition for crisis residential centers and crisis stabilization centers as subtypes of subacute mental health facilities. Section 25 repeals the current definition for crisis stabilization centers since it's replaced with a new definition in Section 24. Section 26 adds a new section in the uncodified law that clarifies that the department will consider any previously licensed crisis stabilization center licenses as a license for a subacute mental health facility. Section 27 adds a new section to the uncodified law to allow the department to adopt transition regulations to implement this act. And finally, Section 28 provides for an immediate effective date of the bill.
Thank you very much. There is a proposed committee substitute to House Bill 170 before us. Can I have a motion to adopt the CS as our working document?
I move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 172, version 32-GH1730-W, as our working document.
Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, we have adopted the committee substitute for House Bill, or we adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 172. That brings us to the opportunity to ask questions. There's, in addition to Ms. Carpenter, there are a number of people on the teams called that are available to answer questions. Folks may have Steve Williams, the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust, is online. Stephen Bookman, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. And in more particular, Mr. Bookman is the person that does most of these hearings for the Department of Law involving mental health holds. And final, Farina Brown, Deputy Director, Division of Behavioral Health, Department of Health and Social Services. All three are on the line. As well as Ms. Carpenter. So if there are questions about the bill, we'll, as usual, see if anyone on the committee has questions, and we'll limit questions to 1 minute. Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps I should ask this question before we passed the adopted the CS. But if I recall correctly, this bill came up at the very tail end of the first regular session. We didn't really have a chance to thoroughly look at it. So I guess we're kind of starting fresh with the new CS, but what is the reason for the CS, or what were the changes, I guess?
Ms. Carpenter is probably the best person to answer that question.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Health and Social Services. We spent a lot of time over the interim working with Representative Clayman, working with the trust, and hearing from stakeholders, individuals who've been involved with this system, just about, you know, concerns with the original draft and even with the CS that was put out by this committee. This is a highly technical area of law. One of the biggest concerns that we heard that we addressed in this CS is that previous, it wasn't clear how the 72-hour hold process worked in this scheme. So we wanted to make sure, especially with input from advocates and from, you know, like I said, the Disability Law Center and the public defenders, that 72-hour clock starts the minute somebody enters a crisis stabilization center. That was extremely important for patient rights. We needed to just clarify some of the drafting, how we did it previously. It was just a little bit confusing, and we tried to kind of put all of the requirements for crisis stabilization centers, crisis residential centers, into the current, what you find in 473710, the hospitalization statute, and we found it was clearer to break that out into those three different subsections, so it was easier for everybody to understand how the law works. Those were kind of the big things. Other changes were just in, you know, errors we found and input from the court system, just clarifying some mays to shalls or vice versa. So it was really just, you know, the effort to clean this up through the process and address patient rights concerns.
Follow up? Representative Kirka.
And then thank you. And then, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, that sexual analysis we just went through was for the CS.
Yes.
Okay. Double check.
And just for a slight more clarity, under the original version of the bill, a person that was taken to a crisis residential center could be held there for 5 days by an ex parte order without ever being seen by a judge. And there was criticism of that from a number of folks saying, you know, if you add the 23 hours at a crisis stabilization center to 5 days at a crisis residential center, a person could be there almost a week and never get in front of a judge, which was actually, the patient advocates thought that is problematic. And so the effort was to make it so that basically whether in any of these three different environments, you'd have a hearing in 72 hours. Further questions, Representative Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has been a long process. It's a long bill, so trying to recollect my memory, and I'll ask for a little bit of clarification. Early on, I had a concern centered around notification of guardians and the timing in which that would occur. And it's clear to me in reading the bill when guardians would have to be notified with respect to the scheduling of a hearing. But I'm forgetting, or perhaps I never had full clarity on when a guardian would have to be contacted following the arrival of an individual at a crisis stabilization center, a residential center, or an evaluation facility. And for the benefit of other members, I appreciate there are challenges associated with even identifying whether someone arriving has a guardian, but I would appreciate clarification on current practices and if and how this version impacts those practices.
I think that's either Ms. Carpenter or, as to current practice in the courts, that may be Mr. Bookman. But Ms. Carpenter, I'll let you have the first run at it.
Chairman Clayman, I'm going to punt this to Mr. Bookman as my subject matter expert.
All right, Mr. Bookman.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Stephen Bookman. I'm the Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. That would fall under the rights statute that exists now. So that would be our change to 7:15 when a facility receives an order for evaluation. It doesn't say when the guardian would be notified. It just says the guardian shall be notified. Currently, that can be sort of an issue in trying to figure out, you know, when notice goes out. With regard to arrival at one of the new centers, I think we might look at the, for residential centers, no, that's the petition, isn't it? This is a good question. Sorry. I think if we look under, on page 5, under the new section 708, line 30, it says when the court grants an application to admit a respondent to a crisis residential center, the court shall set a time for a hearing in the court. And if we go to line 3 on page 6, the court shall notify the respondent's guardian, if any, of the time and place of the hearing. So again, that doesn't say when the guardian would be notified. These are very short-term hearings that may be difficult. The court form, the forms that the court system uses now have places where you are supposed to write down the name and contact information of the guardian if known. And so that would be the way that the court system would be able to do that. But I can't give a precise answer on when it would happen.
Paula?
Not yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Now, in the section that we just read, we said the court shall set a time for a hearing to be held if needed. Who determines if that hearing is needed or if they can just dispense without it?
I'll leave that to Mr. Bookman.
The respondent or the patient. It is our expectation that most people will go voluntary. Certainly most people who arrive at the current facilities, the hospitals, most of them either go voluntary or are simply released by the hospital in that they don't really need to do it. So it would be the respondent who would say, you know, I'm voluntary, I don't need to be here, or it would be the facility who would say, you know, there's no need for you to be here, sir, you can simply go home.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
So through the chair, in a situation where a respondent or the individual that is going to the facility has a parent or a guardian, is it still left to the respondent, or then does that responsibility fall to the parent or guardian, and what happens if neither can be found?
If we are looking at a situation where it is an adult who has like a guardian, then we would be looking to the ward, to the adult ward. That's the current system for DETs and API, that an adult guardian does not have the power to voluntarily admit somebody into one of those places. If we're talking about a minor and we can't find a parent, then we would put the hearing on and we would schedule the hearing, and the minor would have a chance to talk to their attorney and decide what they want to do. If we can't find anybody to consent, we would have the hearing.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Now, I know in several portions of the bill, we're not only addressing those with behavioral crisis or mental health circumstances, but we also deal with those who are gravely disabled. And I'm just wondering what sort of situations are we thinking about where someone's gravely disabled and they're caught up in this bill?
I think that's a Bookman question, too.
again, for the record, this is Stephen Bookman. Representative, We would be looking, because these are such short-term facilities, they would be looking for people who are in immediate danger, people who don't seem to be understanding what's going on with the weather in winter, people who are have some sort of physical medical problem that they're not taking care of. You know, if they have some sort of wound that needs immediate care and they're not taking care of it, they don't mean to hurt themselves, but they just, you know, they don't understand that their ankle is broken or what have you. You might have something where somebody does not appreciate safety, for instance, and just doesn't understand that, you know, you could walk into traffic or something like that. This is a reference to an existing definition, which is under currently 4730.915. And so it's just using the same definition that we have now. And so that's the sort of grave disability we would be talking about.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And I know we also talked about, we've got a number of different types of facilities in this legislation. We talked about directing someone to go to the closest facility. I'm just wondering, would that make sense in all cases? Obviously, different facilities have different tools and different purposes. Are we directing the legislation that someone be sent to the closest facility, even if a more appropriate facility might be just a little bit further away?
Through the chair, this is Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor, GHSS. Representative Eastman, that's a great question, and, you know, we want it to be the nearest if appropriate. So, for instance, you know, if you might be out in rural Alaska, say Kotzebue, and you may have the hospital there set up a crisis residential center, but they're not going to set up a short-term 23-hour crisis stabilization center or have a full, you know, treatment facility that can serve somebody for 30 days. So it absolutely is going to depend on, you know, what is available in the current community and what the level of each individual person needs. The benefit, if we are able to stand up these services in each of the 9 regions that our 1115 behavioral health waiver sets up, we're going to set up a system that has care closer to home. We're going to reduce the need to spend on secure transport into hub communities like Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau. And we're going to, you know, keep people closer to home where their family and community and be able to, you know, have that access to family, culturally relevant care, and all of those benefits while getting the mental health treatment they need. So your question's a great one. And, you know, it would absolutely also be left up to the mental health professionals and the court when they're granting these ex parte orders.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
On page 11, line 11, we talk about the federal facility or federal government that performs evaluations. And I'm just wondering, where are we getting the definition of evaluations on line 11? Is that elsewhere in the bill, or how? How are we to define evaluations? Obviously, it's a medical facility operated by the federal government. I know there's a lot of different variations and varieties of those. What sort of evaluations are we talking about?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, we're talking about the evaluations that are described in AS 4730660 through 4730915, so specific to involuntary commitment and that 72-hour evaluation. I will also follow up. We created a really nice 3-page document that highlights all the definitions from this part of statute that can be a really quick, easy reference, so I'll follow up with that document to the committee. But in terms of not every hospital is going to be equipped to do these evaluations or, quite frankly, want to. So how this model is set up, just like now, a hospital, you know, tells the department they want to be designated to perform these evaluations, and they go through that process. We designate them as a designated evaluation and treatment facility, and then we notify the court that, you know, they can take these involuntary patients to perform these 72-hour evaluations to determine if a 30-day commitment is needed, and also then treat the patient for up to 30 days. So like I said before, our DETs operate just like the Alaska Psychiatric Institute operates. So this bill, and in particular, that evaluation facility is the key to that definition. It's those providers that can perform these evaluations. And a crisis residential center that's going to allow somebody to stay there up to 7 days will have the time to perform these evaluations. So it will be something that the department will, you know, set out those requirements per regulation. We currently do that now for these facilities, and we'll update our regulations to say all of those things they have to comply with. And like I mentioned before, when we say we're operated by a federal government, the federal government that performs evaluations, that might be a tribal health organization, because those aren't licensed by the state of Alaska, but they're operated through their authority under the federal government.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And looking at this same definition of evaluation facility, we've designated the department to keep basically a list of the various types of hospitals or crisis residential centers that meet these criteria. Now, what was the reason for not including federal medical facilities on that same list? I mean, are the federal facilities moving or changing such that it's a burden for the state to keep them on a list, or what's the rationale there? Because obviously, if they've been put on the list, then they meet the requirements. But we're kind of setting aside, and even if they're not on the list, if they're a medical facility, then, you know, they're part of this definition.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, currently there are no medical facilities operated by the federal government that meet this definition in Alaska and that have, you know, designated or raised their hand to the department that they want to do these evaluations. So we are just simply cleaning up this definition to align with what is currently appropriate, and to make it, you know, clearer with how these evaluation facilities should operate and look.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions. Here's my plan for House Bill 172. We will hold a second meeting to address further questions on Monday, February 21st, when we meet it. Not sure whether it's a 1 or 1:30 meeting, but at our meeting on Monday, the same folks will be here to take more questions that you may have. I know the committee substitute was only distributed late this morning. It was just when we got it from Ledge Legal, but I wanted to give you all a chance to have further questions and follow up with the folks that are behind the bill. So we would have a hearing without moving the bill on Monday, the 21st. Amendments to House Bill 172 will be due by email to my office by 5 p.m. on Tuesday, February 22nd. It's my intention to take up amendments to House Bill 172 during our meeting on Wednesday, February 23rd, and then pass the bill on a committee following final questions and discussion. And so at that time, we will hold House Bill 172 for further review. We will also adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, February 18 at 1:30 p.m. The time is now approximately 2:15, and we stand adjourned.